as anybody here. Maybe better on some days. But if you ask me, am I an organized person, I would have to say flat out no, not at all. Being organized would really slow me down. In fact, it would probably render me helpless. I try to keep track of what I'm supposed to do and where I'm supposed to be, but it's true, I don't keep much of a schedule. I think my way of operating has more or less driven Loretta Boss and later Becky Elliott, my two secretaries, around the bend. My style is pretty haphazard. Loretta Boss Parker, personal secretary for 25 years. He has always been like this. His mind works 10 times faster than everybody else's. I mean, he just gets going and stays 2 or 3 jumps ahead. And he's quick to go with what's on his mind. If he gets something in his mind that needs to be done, regardless of what else might have been planned, the new idea takes priority, and it has to be done now. Everybody has their day scheduled, and then, bang, he just calls a meeting on something. In the early years, this caused a number of embarrassments. I would make appointments for him and then tell him about them. We kept 2 calendars, one on his desk and one on mine, but he would just totally forget. I've had people fly in here from Dallas all set to see him. I'd come in at 8 a.m. to meet them and find out he had flown out of town at 5 a.m. without telling anybody where he was going. I would just have to look at this man from Dallas and say, he's gone. So after a few times like that, I finally said, I'm not going to make appointments for you anymore. And he said, well, that's probably best. Then he would make his own appointments and forget about them. And I was still the one who had to give them the bad news. I couldn't organize him in a quarter of a century, and I don't think anyone else is ever going to. Except for reading my numbers on Saturday morning and going to our regular meetings, I don't have much of a routine for anything else. I always carry my little tape recorder on trips to record ideas that come up in my conversation with the associates. I usually have my yellow legal pad with me with a list of 10 or 15 things we need to be working on as a company. My list drives the executives around here crazy, but it's probably one of my more important contributions. David Glass. When Sam feels a certain way, he is relentless. He will just wear you out. He will bring up an idea, we'll all discuss it, and then decide maybe that it's not something we should be doing right now or ever. Fine. Case closed. But as long as he is convinced that it is the right thing, it just keeps coming up week after week after week until finally everybody capitulates and says, well, it's easier to do it than to keep fighting this fight. I guess it could be called management by wearing you down. One way I've managed to keep up with everything on my plate is by coming into the office really early almost every day, even when I don't have those Saturday numbers to look over. 4:30 wouldn't be all that unusual a time for me to get started down at the office. That early morning time is tremendously valuable. It's uninterrupted time when I think and plan and sort things out. I write my letters and my articles for Walmart World, our company newsletter. A. L. Johnson, Vice Chairman, Walmart. I think one of Sam's greatest strengths is that he is totally unpredictable. He's always his own person, totally independent in his thinking. As a result, he is not a rubber stamp manager. He never rubber stamps anything for anyone. Back when I was general merchandise manager, we didn't have much computer support. So every Friday morning for 6 years, I would take my columnar pad with all the numbers on it into Sam's office for him to review. Every morning that I went through those numbers, Sam would jot them down on his own pad and work through all the calculations himself. I never felt that he didn't trust my judgment. He just felt that it was his function to make sure of everything. Sometimes he would work the numbers a little differently from the way I had, or argue with some of my conclusions, which kept me on my toes. The point is, I always knew I could not just go in there and lay a sheet of numbers in front of him and expect him to just accept it. As famous as Sam is for being a great motivator, and he deserves even more credit than he's gotten for that, he is equally good at checking on the people he has motivated. You might call his style management by looking over your shoulder. I'm always asked if there ever came a point, once we got rolling, when I knew what lay ahead. I don't think that I did. All I knew was that we were rolling and that we were successful. We enjoyed it, and it looked like something we could continue. We had found a concept, certainly, that the customers liked. Even back then, I always said at the first sign of it getting out of control, the first time our numbers don't come through as they should, we will pull in and put our arms around what we've built. Up to this point, of course, we haven't had to do it. Ferald Arend. The truth is, we were working with a great idea. It was really easy to develop discounting in those small communities before things got competitive. There wasn't a lot of competition for us in the early days because nobody was discounting in the small communities. So when we discounted items, it was just an unheard-of concept outside the larger towns. The customers, of course, weren't dumb. They had friends and relatives in the cities, and they had visited places where discounters were operating. So when they saw this happening in their town, well, shoot, they just flocked to our stores to take advantage of it. I guess Ferald is right about the competition, if you're talking strictly about discounters. But there's a paradox here that I think confused a lot of folks about us for a long time. For 20 years back east, they always said Walmart never had any competition, and that we wouldn't know what to do with it when it hit us. They forgot that we had come out of the variety store business, and that the Heartland was the home ground for practically all the regional variety chains that developed in the U.S. In our Ben Franklin days, we had all the competition you could ever want, from Sterling and TGNY and Coons and all those other regionals. So while we may not have had any competition for discounting in those little towns, we weren't strangers to competition. We were always looking at Gibson's and any other regionals that might decide to come our way, and we knew what to do when they did. Keep our prices as low as possible by keeping our costs as low as possible. Managing that whole period of growth was the most exciting time of all for me personally. Really, there has never been anything quite like it in the history of retailing. It was the retail equivalent of a real gusher. The whole thing, as they say in Oklahoma and Texas, just sort of blowed. We were bringing great folks on board to help make it happen. But at that time, I was involved in every phase of the business. Merchandising, real estate, construction, studying the competition, arranging the financing, keeping the books, everything. We were all working untold hours, and we were tremendously excited about what was going on. I'm not sure we even had time to realize just how phenomenal our growth rate in the 70s would look on a chart years later. In the early 70s, we had formed this cooperative research group among some of us discounters, mostly regionals, who didn't compete with one another. Comparing notes with them made me realize just what an amazing performance Walmart was turning in. I remember they were just astonished. They could not believe we could be establishing the number of stores that we were. We would be putting in 50 stores a year, when most of our group would be trying to start 3, 4, 5, or 6 a year. It always confounded them. They would always ask, "How do you do it? There's no way you can be doing that." But we were doing it. We just stayed on top of it, and along with increasing our sales, we increased our profitability from $1.2 million in 1970 to $41 million in 1980. On paper, we really had no right to do what we did. We were all pounding sand and stretching our people and our talents to the absolute maximum. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying we didn't have our share of growing pains. Ferald Arendt. More than anything else, we had manpower problems, finding good people and getting them trained in a hurry. Because we always ran a real tight organization, we had no excess people in the stores, so they had to get real good real fast. Back when I had been at Hested's, and at Newberry's too, a guy had to have 10 years' experience before we'd even consider him to be what we called a manager in training. Down here, Sam would take people with hardly any retail experience, give them 6 months with us, and if he thought they showed any real potential to merchandise a store and manage people, he'd give them a chance. He'd make them an assistant manager. They were the ones who would go around and open all the new stores, and they would be next in line to manage their own store. In my opinion, most of them weren't anywhere near ready to run stores, but Sam proved me wrong there. He finally convinced me. If you take someone who lacks the experience and the know-how, but has the real desire and the willingness to work his tail off to get the job done, he'll make up for what he lacks. And that proved true 9 times out of 10. It was one way we were able to grow so fast. We were trying to put in as many merchandising programs as we could and give our stores as much support as possible during all this growth, but in the early 70s, that Walmart manager was still pretty much out there on his own when it came to promoting items and moving the merchandise. Thomas Jefferson, early Walmart district manager, hired from Sterling Stores, later operations manager. Several times a year, most stores would have a big sidewalk promotion. In those days, we sold about as much merchandise off the sidewalks on weekends as we sold inside the store. You know, we'd rope off part of the parking lot, get a band, or have maybe a boatload sale. We would take our boats, we sold these John boats, put them up on sawhorses, and dump one item into each boat. We'd put big signs up calling them boatload sales. They still have sidewalk promotions today, but not like we once did. It doesn't work that well anymore. While all this was going on in the early 70s, Ferald Arendt and Ron Mayer and Bob Thornton and myself were still trying to get a handle on how to distribute to a growing number of stores in these small towns off the beaten path. It was one of those things that used to drive me crazy. I was always walking through the warehouse in Bentonville saying, "Where does this go? Who bought this? We've got too much of that." Meanwhile, the guys out in the stores would be crying for this stuff, and we couldn't get it out to them. I remember being very nervous when everybody decided we needed to buy our own trucks. But we did it. We had 2 tractors and 4 trailers, and the folks in the warehouse got to where they thought we needed 4 tractors and 6 trailers. I thought that was pretty extreme. So word would get out that I was coming out to the warehouse, and if they had an extra tractor or trailer sitting idle, they would haul it around to the other side of the building and hide it, so I wouldn't know we had anything empty. Thomas Jefferson. The faster we grew, the further behind we fell. We were always behind with our distribution. We never opened a warehouse soon enough, and we always had too many stores to service before the warehouse would get opened. Nowadays, I think they stay about 1.5 distribution centers out front of demand. But back then, we had a terrible time getting the freight to the stores. So we were renting outside warehouses, which were very expensive to operate, and we just had more than we could handle. Sometimes we would have 500 trailers full of merchandise sitting around one of those warehouses. And it took time to deal with all that. We couldn't get it out. Then the next day we'd get 60 boxcar loads. We'd have to unload the doggone boxcars, and here the merchandise they wanted in the stores would be sitting there sometimes a week or a week and a half. It was a big problem, and one that worried me a lot, which is probably why, as we moved along in the 70s, I just kept after folks like David Glass, who was still in the discount drug business up in Missouri, and Don Soderquist, who was running Ben Franklin, to come to work for us. I knew they were both big talents, and I knew we were going to need all the help we could get in all areas, but especially in the ones I wasn't all that great at, such as distribution and systems. Like I said before, Ron Mayer had worked hard on that distribution system, introducing all the concepts like merchandise assembly, cross-docking, and transshipment. But I don't think our distribution system ever really got under complete control until David Glass finally relented and came on board in 1976. More than anybody else, he's responsible for building the sophisticated and efficient system we use today. While Ron and Farrell were helping me run the company, and well before David joined us in the mid-70s, Jack Shoemaker was coming on strong as a big talent. He had done a fantastic job in opening stores. Jack had been the manager of a Kroger Supercenter, which was a concept combining groceries and general merchandise, not unlike our own supercenters today. So he had been a merchant, but he wasn't overly experienced when I hired him. He was in that first wave of college men I had started to hire, and being a graduate of Georgia Tech, he had that engineer's love of systems and organization that we were still badly in need of. By now, I was really surrounding myself with guys who were good at all the things I tended to just slough off, like organizing the company to handle the growth explosion we had started. If I hadn't gone after those folks and kept on doing it, we would have come apart somewhere there in the 70s, or we certainly wouldn't have been able to pull off our really incredible expansion in the 80s. Getting an early start on all these systems, building a foundation for our distribution center development, starting to put data processing into the stores, really saved our bacon later on. Jack Shoemaker. Sam and Farrell called me in one day and said, "We understand you've got some experience in writing policy manuals." I had written some for both Kroger and Coast to Coast hardware stores out of Minneapolis, so they said, "We want you to come in and write up our policies and procedures for us." I said, "Well, that's nice, but that's not really what I would like to do. I want to work with the merchandising people." And Sam said, "Well, we would kind of like you to do it anyway. How long do you think it'll take you to do it?" I knew from experience it would take 6 months to a year to properly do this job, but I said, "I'll do it in 90 days. Sam replied, "You've got 60 days. Sam never wants to wait for anything. He has no patience. That was probably the meld between us, that bias toward action. Anyway, we published it, 360 pages of it, in 59 days. As you'll see later, Jack may have been the most controversial guy we ever had in senior management, but he dove right into systematizing things, and he became a great merchant, too. Thomas Jefferson. That whole period, Mayer's time of duty and early Shoemaker, was when we really saw the systems and computers begin to come into our lives at the operations level, the store level. We had been using Class 5 cash registers in all our stores, old hand-crank jobs, you know, which were very slow. Ron talked Sam into buying Singer electric cash registers for the stores, which was a great idea. because you couldn't really have run a business much longer without electric registers. Only trouble was, those Singer registers turned out to be temperamental as hell. Al Miles was the only manager we had who ever really figured out how to work one. So Mayer had the right idea, but the wrong register. As for in-store computers, you'd have to give Shoemaker the credit for that. Not many of us gave in-store computers much thought. But Shoemaker studied all that stuff, and we would run with whatever he talked Sam into putting in the stores. It seemed like we tried to better ourselves with some new gadget every year. That was the beginning of what turned into Walmart's communications system, I guess. But most of us were too busy in the stores to even think about where it was all leading. As we moved along in the 70s, we had very definitely become an effective retail entity. And we had set the stage for the even more phenomenal growth that was going to follow. It's amazing that our competition didn't catch on to us quicker and try harder to stop us. Whenever we put a Walmart store into a town, customers would just flock to us from the variety stores. It didn't take those stores long to figure out that if they were going to stay in business against this thing Walmart had created, they were going to have to go into it themselves. And most of them did eventually convert to discounting. Kuhn's Big K became a discount chain. Sterling launched its Magic Mart discount chain. And Duckwall went into discounting. Now, most of these guys already had distribution centers and systems in place while we had to build one from scratch. So, on paper, we really didn't stand a chance. What happened was that they didn't really commit to discounting. They held on to their old variety store concepts too long. They were so accustomed to getting their 45% markup, they never let go. It was hard for them to take a blouse they'd been selling for $8 and sell it for $5 and only make 30%. With our low costs, our low expense structures, and our low prices, we were ending an era in the heartland. We shut the door on variety store thinking. Chapter 9. Building the Partnership. A quote from Paul Harvey, radio commentator and guest at a Walmart year-end meeting. "What you've created here is better than communism, better than socialism could ever be, better even than capitalism. I like to call what you've got here enlightened consumerism, where everybody works together as a team, and the customer is finally king again." As much as we love to talk about all the elements that have gone into Walmart's success, merchandising, distribution, technology, market saturation, real estate strategy, the truth is that none of that is the real secret to our unbelievable prosperity. What has carried this company so far so fast is the relationship that we, the managers, have been able to enjoy with our associates. By associates, we mean those employees out in the stores and in the distribution centers and on the trucks who generally earn an hourly wage for all their hard work. Our relationship with the associates is a partnership in the truest sense. It's the only reason our company has been able to consistently outperform the competition, and even our own expectations. Now, I would love to tell you that this partnership was all part of my master plan from the beginning, that as a young man I had some sort of vision of a great retailing company in which all the employees would be awarded a stake in the business, that I saw them having the opportunity to participate in many of the decisions that would determine the profitability of that business. I would love to tell you that from the very beginning we always paid our employees better than anyone else paid theirs and treated them as equals. I would love to tell you all that, but unfortunately, none of it would be true. In the beginning, I was so chintzy, I really didn't pay my employees very well. The managers were fine. From the time we started branching out into more stores, we always had a partnership with the store managers. Those guys I've already told you about, like Willard Walker and Charlie Baum and Charlie Kate, all had a piece of their store's profits from the beginning. But we really didn't do much for the clerks except pay them an hourly wage. And I guess that wage was as little as we could get by with at the time. In fairness to myself, though, that was pretty much the way retail was in those days, especially in the independent variety store part of the business. Charlie Baum. When I took over the store in Fayetteville, which would have been May of 1955, Sam was paying the girls 50 cents an hour. After that first paycheck went out, I thought about it and decided, this is for the birds. So the next week I raised them to 75 cents an hour. And I got a telephone call from Sam. He said, Charlie, we don't give raises of a quarter an hour. We give them a nickel an hour. But I didn't cut back. I stayed with the 75 cents because those girls were earning it. We were a high-volume store for those days, making pretty good money. I don't remember being that tight, but I guess Charlie's got it about right. We didn't pay much. It wasn't that I was intentionally heartless. I wanted everybody to do well for themselves. It's just that in my very early days in the business, I was so doggone competitive and so determined to do well that I was blinded to the most basic truth. Really, the principle that later became the foundation of Walmart's success. You see, no matter how you slice it in the retail business, payroll is one of the most important parts of overhead. And overhead is one of the most crucial things you have to fight to maintain your profit margin. That was true then, and it's still true today. Back then, though, I was so obsessed with turning in a profit margin of 6% or higher that I ignored some of the basic needs of our people. And I feel bad about it. The larger truth that I failed to see turned out to be another of those paradoxes, like the discounter's principle of the less you charge, the more you'll earn. And here it is. The more you share profits with your associates, whether it's in salaries or incentives or bonuses or stock discounts, the more profit will accrue to the company. Why? Because the way management treats the associates is exactly how the associates will then treat the customers. And if the associates treat the customers well, the customers will return again and again. And that is where the real profit in this business lies. Not in trying to drag strangers into your stores for one-time purchases based on splashy sales or expensive advertising. Satisfied, loyal, repeat customers are at the heart of Walmart's spectacular profit margins. And those customers are loyal to us because our associates treat them better than salespeople in other stores do. So in the whole Walmart scheme of things, the most important contact ever made is between the associate in the store and the customer. I didn't catch on to that idea for quite a while. In fact, the biggest single regret in my whole business career is that we didn't include our associates in the initial managers-only profit-sharing plan when we took the company public in 1970. But there was nobody around preaching that philosophy in those days, and I guess I was just too worried about my own debt, and in too big a hurry to get somewhere fast. Today, some of our company's critics would like everybody to believe we started our profit-sharing program and other benefits merely as a way to stave off union organizing. The traditional version of what happened is that the retail clerks union organized a strike against us when we opened store number 20 in Clinton, Missouri, and another one when we opened store number 25 in Mexico, Missouri. And that in response to those troubles, we started all these programs to keep the unions out. That story is only partly true. We did have labor trouble in those two stores, and we did fight the unions legally and above board, and we won. In fact, we've never lost a union organizing election. But the idea for sharing profits and benefits had come up even before we went public, not from me, but from Helen. Helen Walton. We were on a trip, driving someplace, and we were talking about the high salary that Sam was earning and about all the money and benefits that he was paying the officers of the company in order to keep his top people. He explained that the people in the stores didn't get any of those benefits. And I think it was the first time I realized how little the company was doing for them. I suggested to him that unless those people were on board, the top people might not last long either. I remembered because he didn't really appreciate my point of view at that time. Later on, I could tell he was thinking about it, and when he bought it, he really bought it. It may be true that our skirmishes with the retail clerks and some other unions along the way, construction unions at our building sites and the Teamsters at our distribution centers, helped hurry along our thinking in this direction. The unions, who don't seem to like our company much, maybe because they've never had any luck organizing us, want everyone to believe they're the only reason we've ever done anything good for any of our associates. The truth is, once we started experimenting with this idea of treating our associates as partners, it didn't take long to realize the enormous potential it had for improving our business. And it didn't take the associates long to figure out how much better off they would be as the company did better. I have always believed strongly that we don't need unions at Walmart. Theoretically, I understand the argument that unions try to make, that the associates needed someone to represent them and so on. But historically, as unions have developed in this country, they have mostly just been divisive. They have put management on one side of the fence, employees on the other, and themselves in the middle, as almost a separate business, one that depends on division between the other two camps. And divisiveness, by breaking down direct communication, makes it harder to take care of customers, to be competitive, and to gain market share. The partnership we have at Walmart, which includes profit sharing, incentive bonuses, discount stock purchase plans, and a genuine effort to involve the associates in the business so we can all pull together, works better for both sides than any situation I know of involving unions. I'm not saying we pay better than anybody, though we're certainly competitive in our industry and in the regions where we're operating. We have to be if we want to attract and keep good people. But over the long haul, our associates build value for themselves, financially and otherwise, by believing in the company and keeping it headed in the right direction. Together, we have ridden this thing pretty darned far. On the other hand, let me say this. Any time we have ever had real trouble, or the serious possibility of a union coming into the company, it has been because management has failed. Because we have not listened to our associates, or because we have mistreated them. I think any time the employees at a company say they need a union, it's because management has done a lousy job of managing and working with their people. Usually it's directly traceable to what's going on at the line supervisor level. Something stupid that some supervisor does, or something good he or she doesn't do. That was our problem at Clinton and at Mexico. Our managers didn't listen. They weren't as open with their folks as they should have been. They didn't communicate with them. They didn't share with them. And consequently, we got in trouble. We fought those situations using pretty traditional methods. We hired a good labor lawyer, John Tate, who has won a lot of organizing battles over the years, and who has since joined our company. His advice helped me become even more determined to change the relationship between management and the associates at Walmart. Take care of your people. Treat them well. Involve them. And you won't spend all your time and money hiring labor lawyers to fight the unions. Right after those confrontations, John helped us conduct a management seminar down at Tanta Ra Resort in Missouri, and soon thereafter we launched a program called We Care, designed to let the associates know that when they had problems, we wanted them to come to management and give us a chance to solve them. Our message became, sure, we are a non-union company, but we think we're stronger because of it. And because you are our partner, we have an open door and we listen to you. And together we can work out our problems. The union, of course, would argue more along the line of, hey, we can get you a $3 an hour raise. Why don't you strike? There's been all sorts of debate over why we chose to call our employees associates. And everybody and his brother takes credit for it. I don't know. Maybe they're right. But the way I remember it is pretty simple. First of all, in my day, James Cash Penny had called his hourly employees associates. And I guess I always had that idea in the back of my head. But the idea to try it at Walmart actually occurred to me on a trip to England. Helen Walton. We were on a tennis vacation to England. We were there to see Wimbledon. One day we were walking down a street in London, and Sam, of course, stopped to look at a store. He always stopped to look in stores wherever we went, anywhere in the world. It didn't matter. On that same trip, we lost a lot of our things in Italy when thieves broke into the car while he was looking at a big discount store. Anyway, he stopped at this one English retailing company, and I remember him saying, "Look at that sign. That is great. That's what we should do." It was Lewis Company, J.M. Lewis Partnership. They had a partnership with all their associates listed up on the sign. For some reason, that whole idea really excited me, a partnership with all our associates. As soon as we got home, we started calling our store workers associates instead of employees. That may not sound like any big deal to some folks, and they're right. It wouldn't have meant a thing if we hadn't taken other actions to make it real, to make it something other than window dressing. The decision we reached around that time to commit ourselves to giving the associates more equitable treatment in the company was, without a doubt, the single smartest move we ever made at Walmart. In 1971, we took our first big step. We corrected my big error of the year before and started a profit-sharing plan for all of the associates. I guess it's the move we made that I'm proudest of, for a number of reasons. Profit-sharing has pretty much been the carrot that's kept Walmart headed forward. Every associate of the company who has been with us at least a year and who works at least 1,000 hours a year is eligible for it. Using a formula based on profit growth, we contribute a percentage of every eligible associate's wages to his or her plan, which the associate can take when they leave the company, either in cash or Walmart stock. There's nothing that unusual about the structure of the plan. It's the performance I'm so proud of. For the last 10 years, the company contributed an average of 6% of wages to the plan. Last year, for example, Walmart's contribution was $125 million. Now, the folks who administer profit sharing, and this includes a committee of associates, have chosen year after year to keep the plan invested mostly in Walmart stock. So the thing has grown beyond belief collectively, and in the individual accounts of a lot of associates. Today, as I write this, profit sharing has around $1.8 billion in it. Equity in the company that belongs to our associate partners. Bob Clark, Walmart truck driver, Bentonville, Arkansas. I went to work for Mr. Walton in 1972 when he only had 16 tractors on the road. The first month I went to a driver's safety meeting and he always came to those. There were about 15 of us there and I'll never forget, he said, "If you'll just stay with me for 20 years, I guarantee you'll have $100,000 in profit sharing." I thought, big deal. Bob Clark never will see that kind of money in his life. I was worrying about what I was making right then. Well, last time I checked in, I had $707,000 in profit sharing. And I see no reason why it won't go up again. I've bought and sold stock over the years and used it to build onto my home and buy a whole bunch of things. When folks ask me how I like working for Walmart, I tell them I drove for another big company for 13 years, one they've all heard of, and left with $700. Then I tell them about my profit sharing and ask them, "How do you think I feel about Walmart?" Georgia Sanders, retired hourly associate, Walmart number 12, Claremore, Oklahoma. I started out in April 1968 and worked as a department head in cameras, electronics, and small appliances. In the beginning, I made $1.65 an hour, minimum wage. In 1989, when I retired, I was making $8.25 an hour. I took $200,000 in profit sharing when I left, and we invested it pretty well, I think. We've done a lot of traveling, bought a new car, and we still have more money than we started with. Over the years, I bought and sold some Walmart stock, and it split a lot. I bought my mom a house off some of that money. For me, Walmart was just a great place to work. Joyce McMurray, district office trainer at Walmart store number 54 in Springdale, Arkansas. I live and breathe Walmart. Sam always gives so much to the associates, I want to give as much as I can back in return. I got my 15-year pen from him personally. I've had the maximum taken out of my check for stock purchases, and I bought some on the outside, too. You cannot imagine how my profit sharing has increased. This year, my profit sharing amounts to $475,000. I had originally planned to retire this year, take my bundle, and bail out. But I'm only 40, and I've decided to hang in here for a while. I'm not sure what we'll do with the money. It's for retirement, of course. But I think we'll also buy a piano and maybe someday build our dream house. But I'm keeping this stock a long time. Jean Kelly, associate in the general office where she supervises cargo claims. I grew up on a farm in Mexico, Missouri, and went to work in store number 25 there when I was 20 years old. When I came to Bentonville, there were 9 people in the traffic department, and now there are 61 of us. My brother tried to talk me into quitting back in the beginning. He said I could go anywhere other than Walmart and make more an hour. Well, in 1981, I had $8,000 in profit sharing. In 1991, I had $228,000. I told my brother to show me anywhere else I could go and do that, and I would change jobs. If you have faith in this company, it's amazing how your loyalty pays off. I'm so glad I stuck to it. My money is going to send my daughter Ashley to college. Those are some of my partners, and we've come a long way together. About the same time we started profit sharing, we cranked up a lot of other financial partnership programs. We've got an employee stock purchase plan so associates can buy stock through payroll deductions at a discount of 15% off market value. Today, more than 80% of our associates own Walmart stock, either through profit sharing or on their own. And personally, I figure most of the other 20% either haven't qualified for profit sharing yet or haven't been with us long enough to catch on. Over the years, we've also had a variety of incentive and bonus plans to keep every associate involved in the business as partners. One of the most successful bonuses has been our shrink incentive plan, which demonstrates the partnership principle as well as any I know beyond just straight profit sharing. As you may know, shrinkage, or unaccounted for inventory loss, theft in other words, is one of the biggest enemies of profitability in the retail business. So in 1980, we decided the best way to control the problem was to share with the associates any profitability the company gained by reducing it. If a store holds shrinkage below the company's goal, every associate in that store gets a bonus that could be as much as $200. This is sort of competitive information, but I can tell you that our shrinkage percentage is about half the industry average. Not only that, it helps our associates feel better about each other and themselves. Most people don't enjoy stealing, even the ones who will do it if given the opportunity. And most associates don't want to think that they're working alongside anyone who does enjoy stealing. So under a plan like this, where you're directly rewarded for honesty, there's a real incentive to keep from ignoring any customers who might want to walk off with something, or worse, to allow any of your fellow associates to fall into that trap. Everybody working in that store becomes a partner in trying to stop shrinkage. And when they succeed, they, along with the company in which they already hold stock, share in the reward. It all sounds simple enough, and the theories really are pretty basic. None of this leads to a true partnership unless your managers understand the importance of the associates to the whole process and execute it sincerely. Lip service won't make a real partnership, not even with profit sharing. Plenty of companies offer some kind of profit sharing, but share absolutely no sense of partnership with their employees because they don't really believe those employees are important, and they don't work to lead them. These days, the real challenge for managers in a business like ours is to become what we call servant leaders. And when they do, the team, the manager and the associates, can accomplish anything. Many people have predicted for years that Walmart would lose its way once we got to the tough challenges of real urban environments. Supposedly, our approach just won't work in neighborhoods with disenfranchised citizens and underprivileged people who have never been winners. The Walmart way can't reach folks who have been thieves and who, for the most part, haven't felt much pride in their lives. But I want to tell you about a visit I made to a store near Dallas a couple of years ago, store number 880 in Irving, Texas. That store has a very young and very ethnic workforce and customer base, and our manager there was doing a terrible job with his people. I think maybe he just said to himself, well, they're young and they're poor whites and blacks and Mexicans, and they're just going to steal, and I can't do anything about it. So he was not, very definitely not, being a servant leader. This store was as bad off as any Walmart I've ever seen. It had the highest shrinkage of any Walmart ever, around 6%, which for us is unheard of. The store was losing more than $500,000 a year, and we thought we ought to close it. But we had a real maverick named Ed Nagy, who was then a district manager. Ed's a fella who's always stepping on toes or breaking one rule or another. He's constantly in trouble, and he likes to try new things, and I have to admit he reminds me a bit of myself as a youngster. He goes into that store, and he has a talk with the store manager, and he starts training the department heads. And he sets some realistic goals for these folks, and he starts giving them some motivational talks, explaining how we're different from other companies and they're really missing out on something by not participating. Then he finds out that the associates are just stealing rampant throughout the store and letting the customer steal too because no one has set any controls. No one was checking on the refunds. No one was checking on the layaways. No one was even checking on the cash registers. If you wanted to steal, you knew you wouldn't get caught. So they started checking on all those things, and they started talking about integrity, and they talked about improving sales. Within a year and a half, this store was turned around completely. The shrink was down to 2%. It started turning a profit. And when I went in there to visit, I think it was one of the proudest moments I've had in 40 years of visiting almost 2,000 stores. It was just an unbelievable job of an action-oriented, right-thinking motivator stepping in and saving a horrible situation. Now, why did it work? Well, for one thing, Nagy, the district manager, took a lot of the department managers out of that store, out of that losing environment, and got them to rubbing shoulders with some of the folks from the successful stores in his district. They had a weekend meeting, and they talked about their departments, and he made these folks participate. Then he had them set their own goals. And maybe while they were having lunch with these winners from the other stores, maybe they started to dream a little and think a little about how they could improve the mess they were in. He and the other managers talked about the numbers with them and began to show them how their jobs and decisions related to those numbers. So they would care about whether their sales were up and not just stand there going through the motions. They began to learn a little about merchandising. But here's the best part. When they put in their controls to try and stop the stealing, they started checking every empty box that left the back door. Well, one day they found a big box, a baby buggy box, that had $400 worth of tapes in it, and they caught the guy at the door with it. So they had a meeting the next morning, and the manager talked about the woman who discovered the box and caught the thief, and she was a hero. Everybody gave her a big round of applause. The culture was turning around there in a short period of time. I learned this early on in the variety store business. You've got to give folks responsibility. You've got to trust them, and then you've got to check on them. It's true that we have more difficulty in the cities with our approach. We have more trouble coming up with educated people who want to work in our industry, or with people of the right moral character and integrity. Folks in small towns in Iowa and Mississippi are more likely to want to work for what we can pay than folks in Houston or Dallas or St. Louis. And yes, they're probably more likely to buy our philosophy in the country than they are in the city. But let me tell you this. A smart, motivational, good manager can work what some outsiders call Walmart magic with folks anywhere. It may take more time, you may have to sift through more people, and you may have to become more skilled with your hiring practices. But I truly believe that people anywhere will eventually respond to the same sorts of motivational techniques we use. If they are treated right and are given the opportunities to be properly trained. If you're good to people and fair with them and demanding of them, they will eventually decide you're on their side. And I want to tell you something else. Walmart is not a big success merely because we grew up out here in the country, where people are just naturally friendly and therefore make great retail employees. It's true that we have many fine associates from the country, but they have had to enter our culture and learn retailing just like anybody else. And we have spent a good deal of time teaching many of them to overcome their natural shyness and learn to speak up and help our customers. So I think some folks outside our company may be putting a little too much emphasis on the supposed low quality of workers in the city, and not enough emphasis on the failure of some managers to do their jobs in getting those workers going in the right direction. Years ago, if we hadn't done so well, some of these folks might have said you could never build a retailing empire in small-town America because you wouldn't be able to attract a workforce that was sophisticated enough. Another important ingredient that has been in the Walmart partnership from the very beginning has been our very unusual willingness to share most of the numbers of our business with all the associates. It's the only way they can possibly do their jobs to the best of their abilities, to know what's going on in their business. If I was a little slow to pick up on sharing the profits, we were among the first in our industry, and are still way out front of almost everybody, with the idea of empowering our associates by running the business practically as an open book. I've always told people in the stores what was going on with the numbers, but after we decided to act like a partnership, we formalized the sharing of information to a much greater degree. Sharing information and responsibility is a key to any partnership. It makes people feel responsible and involved. And as we've gotten bigger, we've really had to accept sharing a lot of our numbers with the rest of the world as a consequence of sticking by our philosophy. Everything about us gets to the outside. In our individual stores, we show them their store's profits, their store's purchases, their store's sales, and their store's markdowns. We show them all that on a regular basis. And I'm not talking about just the managers and the assistant managers. We share that information with every associate, every hourly, every part-time employee in the stores. Obviously, some of that information flows to the street. But I just believe the value of sharing it with our associates is much greater than any downside there may be to sharing it with folks on the outside. It doesn't seem to have hurt us much so far. And in fact, I've been reading lately that what we've been doing all along is part of one of the latest big trends in business these days, sharing rather than hoarding information. All I know is that nothing ever makes me feel better than when I visit a store and some department head comes up to me with pride and shows me all her numbers and tells me she's number 5 in the company, but she plans to be number 1 next year. I love meeting all these merchants we've got on our team out there. When they show me an end cap display they've got loaded up with charcoal or baby oil or lunch boxes, and then tell me they chose that item because of its high profit margin, and then go on to brag about all the volume they've done with that item, I get so proud for them I can hardly stand it. I really mean that. It is just the proudest I get. Because if we as managers truly dedicate ourselves to instilling that thrill of merchandising, the thrill of buying and selling something at a profit, into every single one of our associate partners, nothing can ever stop us. Bernie Marcus, Chairman and Co-Founder, Home Depot. We feel a great affinity for Sam and Walmart because of the way they treat their people. He's such a great motivator. But the financial incentives have made a big difference, too. We modeled our employee stock ownership plan after Sam's, and it worked for us as well. We look at his operation with, what, almost 400,000 people? And you walk in there, and they're all smiles. He proved that people can be motivated. The mountain is there. But somebody else has already climbed it. But if you ask Sam how's business, he's never satisfied. He says, Bernie, things are really lousy. Our lines are too long at the cash registers. Our people aren't being helpful enough. I don't know what we're going to do to get them motivated. Then you ask some of these CEOs from other retail organizations who you know are on the verge of going out of business, and they brag and tell you how great everything is. Really putting on airs. Not Sam. He is down to earth and knows who he is. Without question, Sam Walton is one of the great all-time merchants. Period. Keeping so many people motivated to do the best job possible involves a lot of the different programs and approaches we've developed at Walmart over the years. But none of them would work at all without one simple thing that puts it all together. Appreciation. All of us like praise. So what we try to practice in our company is to look for things to praise. Look for things that are going right. We want to let our folks know when they are doing something outstanding and let them know they are important to us. You can't praise something that's not done well. You can't be insincere. You have to follow up on things that aren't done well. There is no substitute for being honest with someone and letting them know they didn't do a good job. All of us profit from being corrected, if we're corrected in a positive way. But there's no better way to keep someone doing things the right way than by letting him or her know how much you appreciate their performance. If you do that one simple thing, human nature will take it from there. Andy Sims, Manager, Walmart No. 1, Rogers, Arkansas. When I started working at Walmart in West Texas, we would anticipate a store visit by the chairman with the same sense you get when you're going to meet a great athlete, or a movie star, or a head of state. But once he comes in the store, that feeling of awe is overcome by a sort of kinship. He's a master at erasing that larger-than-life feeling that people have for him. How many heads of state always start the conversation by wanting to know what you think? What's on your mind? After a visit, everyone in the store has no doubt that he genuinely appreciates our contributions, no matter how insignificant. Every associate feels like he or she does make a difference. It's almost like having your oldest friend come just to see if you're okay. He never lets us down. There is one more aspect to a true partnership that's worth mentioning. Executives who hold themselves aloof from their associates, who won't listen to their associates when they have a problem, can never be true partners with them. Often this is an exhausting and sometimes frustrating part of the management process. But folks who stand on their feet all day stocking shelves or pushing carts of merchandise out of the back room get exhausted and frustrated too. And occasionally they dwell on problems that they just can't let go of until they've shared it with somebody who they feel is in a position to find a solution. So as big as we are, we have really tried to maintain an open-door policy at Walmart. David Glass. If you've ever spent any time around Walmart, you may have noticed that it's not unusual for somebody in Philadelphia, Mississippi, to get in his pickup on the spur of the moment and drive to Bentonville, where you can find him sitting in the lobby waiting patiently to see the chairman. Now, really, how many chairmen of $50 billion companies do you know who are totally 100% accessible to their hourly associates? I know lots of people in big companies who have never even seen their chairman, much less visited with him. That's not to suggest that they always like what I have to say. I don't always solve their problems, and I can't always side with them just because they bring their situation to my attention. But if the associate happens to be right, it's important to overrule their manager or whoever they're having the problem with, because otherwise the open-door policy isn't any good to anybody. The associates would know pretty soon that it was just something we paid lip service to, but didn't really believe. If I'm going to fly around all over the country telling these folks they're my partners, I sure owe it to them to at least hear them out when they're upset about something. Dean Sanders, Executive Vice President, Operations, Walmart. I've always felt that to Sam, the people in the stores, the managers and the associates, are the kings. He loves them, and there's no doubt they feel they have an open door to him. He'll go out on store visits, and when he gets back, he'll call me and say, "Give this boy a store to manage. He's ready." Then I'll express some concern about the person's experience level or whatever, and he'll say, give him one anyway. Let's see how he does. The other thing, of course, is that he has absolutely no tolerance for managers mistreating the associates in the stores. When he finds something like that going on, he gets on us about it instantly. So you see, when we say Walmart is a partnership, we really believe it. Partnership involves money, which is crucial to any business relationship. But it also involves basic human considerations, such as respect. Walmart is a spectacular example of what happens when 400,000 people come together as a group with a real feeling of partnership and are able, for the most part, to put the needs of their individual egos behind the needs of their team. Chapter 10. Stepping Back.
Hey, Maggie! Sam screams from the cab of his truck. Come on here to me!
Up top, Sam's friend, Royce Beal, a department store owner from Jacksonville, Texas, chuckles.
Listen to Sam a-hollering, he says. It don't do no good, but he'll yell all day like that.
South Point Magazine, February 1990. By the time 1974 rolled around, I have to admit we were feeling pretty good about our accomplishments. By anybody's standards, we had built a heck of a regional discount chain with just under 100 Walmarts open for business in 8 states. We were doing nearly $170 million in sales with more than $6 million in profits. The stock had split twice, and we were on the New York Stock Exchange. By now, everybody was sharing the profits, so the whole company was pumped up. Wall Street was buying into our strategy, and whatever reservations anyone up there might have had about me, they seemed to think pretty highly of Ron Mayer and the rest of the management team we had in place. At 56, I was free and clear of debt. My net worth was far greater than I had ever imagined it could be when I started out in the retail business. Our kids were out of college and starting up their own lives. I really don't see how I could have reasonably expected much more out of life. If I've given the impression so far that Walmart has occupied most of my competitive energy over my years, that's not completely accurate. I've pursued my other passions all along, too, mostly quail hunting and tennis, and I pursued them both very competitively. A lot of businessmen seem to prefer golf, but I always thought it was a little too country club for me, and it took up too much time and wasn't really competitive in the same way that tennis is, you know, in a give-and-take, head-to-head way. Helen Walton. When we first met, Sam played golf, but he would get terribly frustrated when he made mistakes. Once, when he was in the Army, he was out playing with some of the officers, and I think their colonel was along that day. Sam had hit off into the woods. It made him so mad that he broke his club on a tree. So he came home that day, threw his clubs down, and said, I've had it with golf. After that, it was mostly tennis for him. I took my racket with me whenever I was flying, and I had friends to play with when I hit their towns. For some reason, I loved to play around noon, when the sun was hottest. And I guess I was pretty aggressive. I played regularly from the time we got to Bentonville until about 2 years ago, when my legs just couldn't cut it anymore. George Billingsley, tennis partner. For about 10 years, Sam and I played tennis at high noon, usually on the court over at his house. I think he liked to play during lunch hour because he wouldn't dream of taking any of his associates away from their jobs to play. On the court, he was the most competitive player. He studied his opponent's games, and he knew our strengths and weaknesses as well as his own. If you hit a ball to Sam's forehand, that point was his. He would hit it cross-court, and it was over.
He loves the game. He never gave you a point, and he never quit. But he is a fair man. To him, the rules of tennis, the rules of business, and the rules of life are all the same, and he follows them. As competitive as he is, he was a wonderful tennis opponent, always gracious in losing and in winning. If he lost, he would say, I just